See, the thing about a newsroom and think about like starting out in a newsroom is that news directors, they don't care about your feelings or how, you know, they will give you the most...
The ratings.
The radical candor before radical candor was a thing.
Hi, Lee Brooks here, founder of Cromulent Marketing, and you're listening to the first ever Cromunity podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with Matt Trashinsky, director of marketing at MyoVision.
Matthew or Matt?
Sure. Yeah, either one.
I'll take Matt. Sure doesn't help. Well, Matt, thanks for joining us and taking out some longer time today than you were expecting. You're the director of marketing at MyoVision.
I am.
Similar titles can mean different things at different companies. So can you give us a bit of a background? Tell us what it means here for
sure.
Your role?
Absolutely. So thanks for having me to start. Appreciate being the first ever podcast person. That's pretty exciting. So here at MyoVision,
are we early enough
to restart in the podcast? So at MyoVision, we have three different marketing departments. We have a product marketing department, which is led by Matt Denick. We have a kind of comms/internal/external PR department, which is led by Tony, and then we kind of have everything else marketing, which is under me. The biggest part of,
Tony just goes by one name, like Madonna or Cher?
Yeah, Tony's just Tony. Tony just recently actually joined from Desire to Learn. His name's Tony Florio. He's a relatively new member of our team, but he's going to be filling that kind of PR, internal, external comms role. But yeah, everything else that's not kind of PR or comms or product marketing kind of falls under me. So that's, you know, typically demand generation, it's content generation, events, digital marketing, basically anything sales enablement related. So both in terms of creating sales assets, as well as managing those assets to do things like create both our external website and to create our internal resources page. We call sales tools, which is similar to what we had while we worked together at Sandvine.
Just a quick explanation. Sales Tools is an internal resource at Sandvine that houses everything the sales team needs, including external collateral, internal training, and other tools and utilities to help them through the quoting process. Matt didn't mention it here, but one of the first things he did when he arrived at MyoVision was to build a similar resource for their own sales team.
Which is a means to really enable both our partners and our internal sales teams to be able to talk about our products. So basically, if it's not product marketing, or if it's not internal external comms, it kind of falls under the bucket of my scope here at MyoVision.
Okay, so you're making sure all those pieces fit together and
basically
filling in, I don't say gaps, but it only works if all the pieces are
right. It's making sure that if I was to say I had like one mission, it's to make sure that we have these really great visions and ideas of where we want to go as a company. Are tied to smart cities and the smart city movement. My role is to make sure that we're actually practically day-to-day creating content and running programs and, you know, having a presence at events that reflects kind of our vision and where we're going and making sure that that gets executed at a more day-to-day kind of tactical level.
Okay. And what's the career path that brought you to MyoVision?
Yeah, so my very first job out of school was actually in broadcast, is in news. So I worked for Rogers First Local News. Here in town in Kitchener-Waterloo.
Is that the Channel 20?
Yeah, it is Channel 20. So I was a videographer for them, which meant that every morning I would go in and I would get my news assignment for the day, and they would send me out with a camera and a truck, and I'd have to go talk to people, get back by 2 or 3 o'clock, cut together an entire spot, and then kind of be on air for 5 p.m., that was my very first early step into kind of the communications world was on the journalism side. From there, the feedback I had gotten was that I looked far too young to be on camera.
Workplace discrimination.
Yeah, that little bit of ageism. See, the thing about a newsroom and think about like starting out in a newsroom is that news directors, they don't care about your feelings or how, you know, they will give you the most...
The ratings.
They're radical candor before radical candor was a thing.
Yeah.
Right? Radical candor is all about, like, being brutally honest with people, you know, because you care about them and because you want them to be better.
That's marketing right there.
Yeah, that's it.
Let's dress the original, up our grumpiness.
The original radical candor was just news directors telling people they were garbage and not really caring.
Like that Whiplash, you seen that? That
yes, yeah. That's good kind job, of it.
The two most destructive words in the English language.
That was it, right? So they weren't afraid to be like, look, you're a good reporter, you put together good stories, you're a good videographer, but you look too young and you have no credibility because you look so young. So I found that to be really discouraging. Because like
come back in 10 years, kid.
Yeah, just gotta go smoke a bunch and drink a bunch just to age myself. So I ended up leaving journalism and going into the kind of general marketing communication side at a local company that's predominantly government funded, but it's kind of a half charity, half NGO. And kind of did general marketing communications for them, which is like most people starting out in the kind of marketing world, you're kind of the jack of all trades. Kind of have need to know everything. You got to be able to run events and write a press release and do the website. And you're just the guy, right? You're the marketing guy. So I did that for a while, but I knew that like the reason why my wife and I kind of moved to Kitchener-Waterloo is because I wanted to work in tech. Just so happened that when I got here, BlackBerry was laying off, so there wasn't a whole bunch of opportunities at the time. So I kind of worked in that role.
There was an oversupply,
yeah. Which is a lot different now. I mean, now there's a real demand out there for marketers in town, but back then there was probably less so. But I ended up finding a role at Sandvine through actually you and Matt Denick.
So as Matt said, he and I worked together at Sandvine. We also worked with Matt Denick, who was on my team, and then referred Matt into the organization.
That was my first foyer into marketing and tech, and that was in product marketing, which was awesome. I genuinely love product marketing. It's one of my favorite types of marketing or flavors of marketing, and it really fit my personality well because anytime I can get a peek behind the curtain about something new that's coming or, you know, new technology that, you know, only a few people in the world know about, I want to be one of those people.
So, I think in tech, you need to have a certain level of an inquisitive mindset to investigate. Because if you can't understand something, how are you going to help someone else?
And that's a cool part about being a product marketer is, you know, there's sometimes where the engineering teams and maybe the product teams are coming up with these brand new things that are truly revolutionary technologies, like world first type stuff. Right? But they need someone to help them tell the story of why it's important.
Yep.
So they may have invented just the next
bread slicer
or something, right? That's just going to change the world.
But people need to know about it.
But people need to know about it.
They need to know what it does.
and why they should care, right? Yeah. And imagine,
is it really the best bread slicer?
Right. Well, I mean, the first bread slicer was probably a big deal, but how many, was it well marketed? But I mean, the kind of the product marketer's role is to try and take these new things that are coming to market and help connect them with the buyers and the people who have problems and match technologies to problems and problems to customers. And I think that's a really, really awesome role. So I did that at Sandvine and I genuinely loved it there because it worked with the internet and a lot of the trends like the Global Internet Phenomenon Report would be, you know, unveiling new things to the world that we saw for the very first time.
For those unfamiliar, the Global Internet Phenomena program is an ongoing thought leadership program run by Sandvine, which is essentially an in-depth study of consumer internet traffic trends around the world.
Just thinking back, things like when Pokemon Go launched, and we did like a whole bunch of analysis of Pokemon Go. Yeah, like people wandering around, and we did some analysis to figure out like how much data does Pokemon Go actually use. That was the first time anyone had ever heard like how much data this kind of new app that they're doing actually would affect something like their data plan. So I really like that role because you got to be this kind of intersection between
what's new and learning and helping others learn.
It's really cool. So I came to MyoVision under the same pretense to kind of come and do product marketing here. But that kind of quickly grew into expanding back to kind of my background in general marketing and kind of comms to be able to kind of go beyond just the scope of of product marketing. So I found myself helping a lot of the team on a lot of projects, you know, helping with events, helping with, you know, basically the day-to-day kind of running of the department. And then eventually kind of moved into the official role of managing kind of the day-to-day operations, just because I just happened to be so involved with kind of every aspect of what was happening from a marketing point of view.
But I guess worth noting, for the non-Sandvine alumni listening to this, that we had quite a well-integrated, very cooperative, high-functioning marketing team. So our product marketing team was exposed very much to what the Marcom team was doing and product management. And I guess that helped us all see beyond our own specific areas of accountability or responsibility to how to fit into the bigger picture, which I think is what you're touching
absolutely
on here, that stepping in it and knowing how those pieces all fit together to run efficiently.
I think that's it. I think I came in with that kind of mindset baked in to me. Right?
Well, wasn't it like a Manhattan project where, you know, you add these two numbers, you hand it to someone else, you don't know what they're used for?
Yeah, you need to be aligned from top to bottom, right? So I think I came in from that background at Sandvine where everyone just inherently worked together. And product marketing, certainly at Sandvine, but in a lot of places, tends to act as the glue or the binding agent for all these different departments, right? And I think that stepping into MyoVision was a good chance for me to kind of be that binder here and take a whole bunch of other projects that we're working on and kind of bring them all together under one strategy, under one direction. So that, again, similar to how it was at Sandvine, is we're all aligned to a common purpose, common goals, common strategies, and making sure that from the products that are being built to how they're coming to market, to how we talk about them in the market, to what we say at our trade shows, they're all aligned and they're all driving towards a common goal, which is, you know, for MyoVision, it's to really be a smart city leader.
And it might seem almost silly to say, but with tech companies, especially when you start with a piece of technology, you know, it sounds obvious to say everything should be aligned, but when companies have their origin with a piece of technology and they're used to just sort of shouting about that technology to the world, the idea that you need maybe a larger strategy of how are you actually going to reach people who haven't heard of you? What language do they use? What problems do they have that need to be solved? These are layers above that maybe if you do things right will get you that conversation about your piece of technology, but it comes much later in the buying process or from the customer's perspective, more their journey to finding a solution.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, I think you need both paths baked into your kind of customer journey. So if someone really does come in at a product level and they want to know why your widget or your box is the best widget or box there is, that involves kind of taking them up the messaging stack and showing them why
why did
we build this thing, what kind of problems does it solve, you know, what changes has this box made on the careers and businesses that we work with today. Like,
A good point, because their understanding of it, they might think is very complete,
right?
But it might not be. And it's something that differentiates your solution might be critically important to the real world success, but if they're not aware of the nuance there.
Yeah.
So you're almost preparing a framework in their mind for how to evaluate potential solutions.
Right. So exactly. So In the occasion where someone does come in at a product level, I believe it's about kind of differentiating that product and then, again, tying it back to the broad reasons why you would choose to work with MyoVision or kind of get on board for the problems or the use cases this product provides. I think for the most part, though, and this is a large transformation that we've recently undergone here at MyoVision, is to become far more solution-focused. And we actually, above solutions, we have a category that we call impacts here at MyoVision. So we have products, solutions, and impact categories. And I think for the most part, when people go to try to solve problems, they're looking for solutions to their problems, not products.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to still have everything around products and the technology. And when someone gets to the bottom of the funnel and they really are looking at the specs and speeds and feeds and the technical differentiators, I think it's incredibly important to have those resources.
But
I think for the most part, for the most part, those are the next step. And most people are coming in because they're out there looking for an actual solution to their problem.
Sometimes we in tech forget that our customers are people.
Right.
We get so focused on the technology, and people are, they're looking for problems, or they've been, or they're looking for solutions to a problem, or they've been asked to find a solution to a problem, right, or it's something they're experiencing themselves, and they don't start by Googling or Binging your product name, unless you're one of those companies that has managed to achieve, you know, monopolistic success, right, in which case, if you're done.
Yeah, if you're Kleenex, yeah, good job, Kleenex.
Google, for instance. Yeah, Kleenex, something eponymous. No, they're gonna search for the symptoms they're feeling and a solution to those symptoms or those problems. And you better hope your name comes up on the first page.
Yeah, so that's it. I mean, the way that I think about it is, so the reason why we have even one higher level above that, which we call an impact category, is because in MyoVision's industry, there's funding sources.
Matt didn't mention this while we were recording, but without getting into the details, after introducing the solution and impact level messaging onto the website, MyoVision saw very positive results.
So governments actually get funding buckets to solve broad smart city problems. So you would get, maybe you get some funding to your city to make your city safer, right? Or you would get funding to reduce congestion, right? So they're not really...
So like Vision Zero or economic development.
Exactly, or clean air. Like, yeah. So they're not really solutions because you can't, you know, there's no product today that just goes and sucks carbon out of the air. Well, I guess there are some
plants.
Giant vacuum plants.
trees.
But at a highest level, I mean, it's about... We want to be talking about those things that our products help with, and our products help with safety, and they help with... congestion reduction and air quality improvements.
Well, that's really interesting because you have people who are customer demographics who superficially look the same could come at you from different angles.
Exactly.
And if you're really good at one, you might be missing the others. And so that, I know that's always a bit of a friction, is you don't want to be too broad and say, well, we do everything for everyone and try to cast an infinitely broad but very thin net. So then it really comes down to understanding the market. How might people actually investigate solving a problem?
And this is like tying back to actually helping people solve problems. So the smart city market's so big and the smart city term is so broad that it basically wraps around anything and everything. And it's something that cities actually struggle with.
Yeah.
Is they're supposed to have a smart city plan, but smart city means literally everything.
Some elected representative has said smart cities.
How do we get started, right? So
I have a vision for 2020. We will be a smart city.
We will be a smart city. Go do it. How do you practically get started, right? And that's where we've kind of carved out this little section of smart city for MyoVision. And like, this is what MyoVision just defines as our kind of section of the smart city.
That's intelligent transportation.
It's around, again, reducing accidents. It's about improving air quality, reducing congestion. So that's our highest level, right? Is that tied?
Just those things you casually listed there are different use cases or outcomes, whatever, of a single, you know, intelligent transportation network can give you these multiple benefits or results.
So that's correct. So that's the journey that I would like people to go on, is they're out there and they're searching, like, I want to reduce pedestrian fatalities in my city, right? They're eventually going to, hopefully they land on our website under our kind of like how our solutions impact safety. But then they start learning about what actual solutions we have around safety.
Yeah.
So the ability to time the intersections correctly, analysis for safety around pedestrians, some of the things that are more solution focused, that are like use cases that we do with our technology. And then eventually they can get down to the products that they need to buy that would actually go out, you'd install at the infrastructure level to solve it. So they're going from this journey where they're out there searching for something really broad, like I want to reduce congestion, to finding solutions that reduce congestion, which is to say, retime your signals, better use your roadways instead of, you know, building new roadways.
Yeah.
And finally getting down to, oh, there's a product here, you know, it's called Traffic Link here in MyoVision, I have to install it and that's what I need, right? People could come at any stage there. People could come at the highest level. People come because they're Googling, a solution. People could come because they've heard about our product before. So they come in on the product. If they come on the product, you got to work your way up and show them how this product differentiates itself.
Kind of reset a little bit to set yourself up well for the conversation.
Exactly. So it's about really having that stack and then guiding your customer or potential customer or prospect through that journey with whatever their pain point is, like wherever they're coming in actually.
And that stack or that journey is essentially a story. And we had talked a little bit earlier, forgot to record, about one lesson that you've taken. I think initially you said you'd sort of applied or maybe picked up at Sandvine, but in our conversation, determined it. I really went back much further, which is just the importance of storytelling and how everything is really a story.
Right. So I remember there's one really clear thing that has always stuck in my mind. Again, this is the years past influence of news directors on me, but I was doing
and even rhetoric,
yeah. Going back to my education, which is in communications and rhetoric. But going back, you know, there was a story I was doing about it was a controversial decision to put in stop signs in a neighborhood. And my original story that I had pitched was,
you don't have time to stop on the way. I know, somewhere.
Just make them all yield signs. That way, everyone's careful, but children, no one has to stop. But it was a story about stop signs.
What a yield sign! What a cop out!
Every just yield signs everywhere, and everyone just drives carefully,
implicitly.
But the story was on the stop signs, and my original pitch was to like kind of go right towards, go talk to council about stop signs, and go talk to the traffic department about stop signs.
Why are you against child safety? Why,
yeah, like so. But the kind of feedback I immediately got from my news director was no. You start out with kids playing street hockey, right? And the kids are looking happy playing street hockey. And then you show the mom. The mom's in the window and she's watching the kids. And then you talk to the mom and you're like, how important is your kid's safety to you? And the mom says, safety is incredibly important.
6 out of 10.
Right? Yes, yeah, 6 out of 10. It's not my number one concern. But the goal there was like, Matt, you're not telling a story about these stop signs.
You're simply presenting a fact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So his whole point, and I think it's always stuck with me, was no, go put some context around these stop signs. Mm-hmm. Like, what do these stop signs actually mean? What does the beginning of the story look like? Was it the stop signs are proposed because these kids playing hockey who have almost been hit 4 times this week? They play a lot of hockey.
Yeah.
But now the stop signs are coming in. So that mom's super happy, but then the grumpy neighbor down the street says, this is outrageous because I like to
Let's draw cruise. False equivalence.
Right? Like but it's a there's context there and there's a story there.
Yeah.
And so you can either go out and you can tell the
It is. It's a much more complete picture.
Yeah. Right. So you got two choices. You can either go and be like, there is a proposed stop sign. Yeah. These are the pros and cons.
Yeah.
Public decide. Which, I mean, some of us do think that way. I think that, like, I'm a very pragmatic person personally when it comes to like, decision making. But a lot of people want to hear a story. And that kind of transferred to Sandvine well in the sense that, you know, again, technology-focused company, really great technology. But again, working
with incredibly specific technology to solve. Right. An incredibly specific problem.
So, you know, just kind of always being the champion of and reminding people that, you know, we're not solving technology problems. We're solving people's technologies problems, mm-hmm. right? Like
we're solving people's problems with technology.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So I think just continuing that thread and then again, bringing that here to MileVision is putting a focus on customer stories. And like we recently did a project called the world's smartest intersection in Detroit. And the goal there was to really put Detroit first.
Yeah.
Right. And to kind of explain how we've helped Detroit transform their city, how we've been part of Detroit's rebirth, but all from Detroit's point of view and less about the technology. The technology's incredibly important. And we eventually get to the technology and eventually we get to the technology differentiators, but it starts out with the story of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
right? And why they got to the point where they needed technology in the first place and so what problems were they trying to solve?
Let's talk about that. I was going to ask you about it. Recently to catch people up, MileVision made headlines, certainly in the transportation industry, with the world's smartest intersection,
I got recognized at a poll station here locally.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
I came from Detroit and came to vote in our provincial election, and I was wearing a smartest intersection shirt.
Yeah.
And one of the guys who mentioned polls was like, world's smartest intersection in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's awesome. Yeah. I was like,
take that, Honda.
Because we're like, we sell the governments. The fact that anyone in the public knows anything about MileVision is, that's always heartwarming for me.
That is great. So can you tell us a bit, you're starting to, but can you tell us a bit about that project and then the supporting marketing program, which I think was probably one of your largest, if not your largest initiatives this year?
Yeah, it was by far our largest initiative this year. It was, to go back a little bit, Detroit's our largest customer. Detroit's been a very longstanding customer of ours as well.
Which might surprise people, right? They think Detroit and they think M&M 8 Mile or, you know, population.
Yeah.
Detroit's been going through some challenges.
So Detroit now has, today, I believe...
It's almost a reboot.
It's a reboot.
In terms of they are adopting technology.
They get to kind of start over.
Yeah.
They get to start over.
So, and not to diminish the human impact and suffering that's happened there, but just to highlight that people don't know the full Detroit story.
Right. So the Detroit story today is about the people who have stayed behind. So that's the way that Detroit Titan tells their story today, is there was lots of people who left Detroit, but, you know, so there's about 3 million people who used to live in Detroit, and now it's about 700,000.
Area.
Yeah. And now it's about 700,000, and the people who stayed behind are the ones that are kind of rebuilding Detroit. And that includes the traffic teams. The traffic teams, you know, a lot of people think of traffic as being abstract, right? Or they think of like, or they live in a city like Kitchener-Waterloo where the infrastructure is relatively good and stable.
Yeah.
So you're not constantly looking, you might complain about congestion, but you're not typically complaining that the traffic lights are just off.
Yeah.
Or literally falling off their masts.
Yeah,
or,
that is an alien problem, right, I think, to most people.
Right. So Detroit had far more kind of realities around these problems where their infrastructure and their electrical grid was so bad that they would have rolling brownouts. And those brownouts would knock out entire portions of their traffic network. And because of kind of some of the social problems, they would just be out for weeks, because typically they'd be relying on people calling in and telling them that things were wrong. People just wouldn't call the city.
Yeah, like there isn't, or there wasn't an automatic system in place to alert someone.
Exactly. So
sections of infrastructure are not functioning.
Exactly. So our first use case was for Detroit, is they had this, which is incredibly unsafe. So I don't know if you go to a four-way intersection that's in flash, that's when the lights are blinking, that's relatively safe if everyone kind of stops.
Yes, and everyone needs four-way to follow the same rule.
But they were having a lot of bad accidents based on the fact that the traffic lights were out, mm-hmm. and people were just like driving through them and treating them like, there's no lights, I don't really need to stop.
Yeah.
And then when you get to basically four-lane intersections that the lights are out, really dangerous, especially ones with left-hand turns, like they get really, really bad. It was affecting safety, they were having accidents, and it was all because people just weren't calling in or they weren't able to find these intersections fast enough. Mm-hmm. So the first problem we came in and solved for Detroit was to just get their infrastructure connected and give them alerts, kind of.
So you're talking, you know, messaging is smart cities and all this automatic, really technologically advanced stuff. But your actual first use case with Detroit was
tell us if the lights are on. And from there, we worked with Detroit and we started pulling analytics back from their traffic to optimize traffic based on data. We started getting connected vehicles, dynamic safety alerts. And we've been kind of building with Detroit all of kind of these new world-first technologies. So we thought, what better place than Detroit to deploy what we're calling the world's smartest intersection, which is actually a series of intersections along
a corridor, if you will.
A corridor of intersections, correct. And basically put not only our entire functionality into them, but also some technology that we're developing as part of MyoVision Labs, which is our research and development arm, into this kind of brand new, exciting corridor, and declare, you know, the world's smartest intersection in Detroit.
I understand that in the past few days, Honda has announced
the first world's smartest.
So they are wrong.
They
demonstrably
are
wrong.
Yeah. So we've done our best to link to the publishers of those articles, the world's smartest intersection, which was in the summer, to show that they are.
They can have the world's smartest.
Yeah, they can have a smart intersection,
yeah,
certainly, but they're certainly not the first, and they're certainly not the smartest. So that was a huge thing for us, and that produced a lot of interest for both MyoVision as a company and our solutions.
Well, and you launched that at ITS.
ITSA, which is the largest trade show of the year, and it was actually in Detroit.
Detroit, yeah.
So it was a really, really great project that really put Detroit first from a story point of view, and was the story of Detroit, how they went from, you know, rolling brownouts and how did I know if my lights are even on or off, to having the world's smartest intersection in their city.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your booth graphics are basically the world's smartest intersection.
Yes.
Right? The MyoVision part is
further down
in the story.
We really wanted to make it like a Detroit story, mm-hmm. and a world's smartest intersection story. And then MyoVision is the technology that's powering.
Yeah.
Right? So not
Intel inside.
That's a big change for tech companies. So, right? If you've always been, and you love your technology, and you want to, I think a lot of people instinctually,
right?
They want to put their technology first because their technology is better. So it can be difficult to step back and say, look, our technology is not the hero here.
Yeah.
The hero is our customer.
Yeah.
Right? The hero is all the amazing stuff that they're doing with our technology.
Yeah. The story becomes the rising tide that
pulls you along, exactly. or from our Sandvine days, the Global Internet Phenomena Report, was to educate everyone.
Right.
Some of everyone is, you know, a subset of everyone is our customer base. So it served a marketing need.
Absolutely.
But we really tried to make those reports and studies about the data and about the stories that were being told and what the analysis said, rather than, you know, the technology that was enabling it or that could provide solutions to the problems we were identifying.
And back to the solutions approach, it's allowed a whole bunch of cities and engineering firms and a whole bunch of people come to us and they say, I want to like solve safety in the same way that Detroit's mm-hmm. solving it. Or I want to like reduce congestion in the same way that Detroit's doing it.
So the program was...
we're showing examples of those solutions working.
Yeah.
And then we say, okay, Detroit's doing it with our technology. They're doing it with our products. Oops. I just knocked a phone off. I'm talking with my hands. I get really excited because then you have other cities that are like, I want to put those same solutions into play.
So this program, the World's Smartest Intersection and the marketing activities around it without getting, I guess, too into the details here, has worked. You know?
Yeah,
I think, of what you said earlier in the introduction, that you have a strategy and then different parts have to execute on it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it might have been different from what MyoVision's done in the past, what other tech companies would naturally do. But this really proves that you guys made the right decision.
Yeah, I mean, so we've had really good results from it, from both a name recognition point of view, from a lead generation point of view, brand point of view, just from even existing customers that are coming to us and saying we want to expand our deployments based on what Detroit's doing.
Because customers might, this is a phenomenon that other companies might face, the existing customer believes they have a very complete knowledge of your solution.
Exactly.
And they might not stay up to date. And one, we'll touch on it in a second, I'm a little bit familiar with your solution. One aspect of it is that being largely software-based, it can continually evolve.
Absolutely.
Based on just the same sensors that are already in place. So new use cases become logic rules that are implemented in software. So a customer from 3 years ago who thinks that they know everything you do might actually not. And then seeing the Detroit, the World's Smartest Intersection, they go, whoa, what? Hey, so we've got four of those, but those other five are really cool.
Exactly. So you talk about like account management and growing your existing customer base and the software licenses that they have. Yeah, maybe they bought us 2 years ago and they're still just using us for the most basic armor lights on or off use case.
Yeah.
Because that's what they bought 2 years ago. That's what they're using us for. That's what they associate our product with.
They might not know that it can do
connected vehicle integration.
Or how easily it can do that.
Or that it's just software, that they don't have to go and buy an entire new piece of hardware to kind of unlock this, right?
Yeah.
So we try to use the smartphone analogy where, you know, you don't buy one phone to be a calculator and then you go buy another phone to play Angry Birds and you buy another phone to shop on Amazon. It's you buy one phone and then everything else is just software.
Right? Yeah.
We want to do the same thing for our customers where they buy an infrastructure piece and then everything on top of that is just the software license that they can enable or disable based on kind of their, again, going back, their problems. But the World Smartest Intersection project is just a really good example of a really integrated marketing approach where everyone from what we're doing in press and PR to the events that was going to be happening around it. We did customer events. We did launch events. We did the actual ITSA trade show. They were all aligned to the program. Webinars. We launched a brand new website. We created a whole bunch of new collateral. We created, actually, with Cromulent, a technical showcase that went deep into the technology. So we kind of, we created an augmented reality experience where you could put on a Microsoft HoloLens. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was like you were standing at the intersection. We created a whole bunch of new assets that were really extremely cross-functional in the marketing approach, right? We had digital marketers and event marketers and program marketers and product marketers. Everyone's working on this one big major initiative. And certainly with the size of our kind of MyoVision team, we weren't entirely able to do it alone. So we kind of found a bunch of partners in the community to work with on this project. So obviously we don't have someone in-house that could create an augmented reality experience. So we kind of went outside for that. And then I think one of our challenges is being able to create technical content extremely quickly. And that's kind of that's where Cromulent got involved.
Let's touch on that for a second for purely self-interested reasons. So we at Cromulent played a small part in the program. I'm not going to try to oversell what we had done here, but Matt reached out to us, and we write about this a little bit on the website. Matt reached out to ask us if we could produce a technical showcase document that went a little bit behind the scenes into how the technology actually works. So listing some of the use cases that were part of the higher level messaging, and then explaining, you know, how the bits and pieces come together to make it work. And that was Matt's idea to have that type of document. So let me just ask you, Matt, what led you to either spot that need or to make that decision?
Right. So during my time at Sandvine, I saw how incredibly effective white papers and technical showcases were as bottom of funnel pieces of content, right? So you can customer stories and high level blog posts and webinars and pitch decks, they're all great for like top of funnel, middle of funnel. But then eventually, especially selling to engineering types, they want to know how it works eventually, right? Like, they want to know the guts of it. They want to know what protocols, they want to know how it integrates in the architecture. And, you know, it's incredibly important that when they get to that level of content, there's something there for them, mm-hmm. right? Because everything else, they understand there's going to be like quote unquote marketing fluff, yeah. right? But then as they get deeper, and if they stop and all they get is just marketing.
I ask you not to use such derogatory terms about marketing.
Well, I mean, like as you get deeper, you kind of expect it to get a little bit more technical.
Yeah.
And I knew that with the World Smartest Intersection project, there's going to be a bunch of people that are okay to just know that's the smartest intersection in the world, and I think that's cool. There's going to be a bunch of people that want to know about the solutions and the use cases, and that's cool. And then I know that there's going to be a bunch of people that are out there that are going to be saying like, okay, this is awesome, but like, show me the box. Show me the, what does roadside artificial intelligence mean?
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do you do?
Maybe they're skeptical. Maybe they're genuinely interested.
Right.
Maybe they're really excited and want to understand the technology so they can right. explain it internally.
So there needs to be something there for those yeah. people. Because that could be a blocker to a buying decision, right?
And that's like, something that...
The technology is so far ahead. And again, before you can differentiate,
these are
world you need
first
to educate.
Right? These aren't things that every vendor is talking about.
Exactly. So you kind of need to contextualize it for people. You need to... You know, I've heard described as like building a bridge, right? So if you...
Yeah,
if
I always talk about what... product marketing does is bridging a gap between, you touched on earlier, customer problems and the solutions that we
right.
have.
That might involve, you know, we have a product here that takes two NVIDIA graphics cards and puts them at the side of the road so we can do deep neural network analysis, AI, machine learning type algorithms
yeah.
in real time at the intersection. That's the first time that this is being done, yeah. right? So it's important that someone...
You're not going to lead with that, but someone right. at some point will
At some point will be like...
Well, how do you do that real time?
How do you recognize that a pedestrian's crossing the road without the latency of going to
yeah.
the cloud or something, right?
Yeah,
and it's like,
exactly.
So it's... And for those are... That's a really awesome question. Like, I love that question.
It's not a question that a BDR or a sales rep or an account
no.
manager is, you know, in most circumstances, going to be able to answer on the spot or accurately.
Right. So having that content there that they can say, I don't know, but hey, I'm going to flip you this thing that goes really deep into the technology behind something like the World's Smartest Intersection. It can explain everything that they would say better anyway, and allows them to just be the trusted expert of the customer and not try to get off on some wild tangent where they're trying to explain our technology. And if you're talking to a technical person, they might understand or see that you don't really...
Yeah, it can be very detrimental.
Yeah.
Right.
Or
right.
it just seems like you're making stuff up or
yeah.
whatever. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Oh, this person doesn't quite know what they're saying, or they actually say something wrong, and then credibility is lost.
At a tactical level, I really wanted to make sure that this project in the World's Smartest Intersection that was perceived as being not just a vaporware PR stunt, because all this stuff is actually working in Detroit, and like all the technology, all the use cases are real, and things that we did and how we have examples and data from.
Yeah, these aren't hypothetical.
They're not hypothetical. Yeah. So I really wanted someone to be able to dig in and really get into the weeds on what the implementation looked like, what the architecture looked like, how this stuff functions. And again, if they're out there and they're the buyer, and our buyers are engineers, just like at Sandvine, they need to be able to trust you that you are able to keep up with them in terms of technology.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a great piece of content. I think it's a great kind of piece of content to be gated. So we have that one behind a form fill.
Well, actually, this is a good segue because I wanted to ask
yeah.
you about this as well. You'd mentioned earlier that you have a pretty robust attribution model in place.
Correct.
For different, I don't know if it's company-wide or marketing assets. Yeah, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure.
So this one is linked to a form fill.
Yeah, so we have a multi-touch attribution model here at MileVision, which basically means anytime a customer interacts with any piece of digital content, we basically fingerprint that interaction and then tie that back to a complete customer journey that then eventually adds in an opportunity or a sale. So if someone attends a webinar, We fingerprint it. If someone downloads something like the World Smartest Intersection tech paper, we take a note of that as well. And basically what you get by documenting all those interactions is you're able to attribute revenue and pipeline and this kind of demand generation through multiple touches rather than just, say, last touch or first touch. So a lot of people...
You have a very complex, very long sales cycle.
Exactly. So and what you, we don't have...
You don't have an add to cart button.
Right, exactly. So if you're B2C, you might, you know, have a pair of sunglasses or something, and then someone sees your ads, they click it, it's got a promo code for 20% off, they put it in their shopping cart, put it in their credit card, and that's really easy to tie that promotion back to that sunglass sale. For us, it's
18
like
months.
18 months. And someone could come in on a webinar, they watched two more webinars, they downloaded three technical showcases, they saw us at an event, and then eventually they bought or something, right? So for us, it's about each one of those marketing activities is giving the proper attribution to the sales process. So that way, when the sale goes through, we can take a look at all those steps and say, how did all the marketing activities cumulatively add to that sales actually happening?
And these aren't those vanity attribution metrics where you add them all up at the end and they're 10 times your revenue.
No, they're basically the way it works is you take the touches or different points at which the customers have interacted with your content. You take customer milestones, which would be like creating an opportunity in something like Salesforce, closing the deal the first time we saw them, like the major kind of customer journey points. Yeah. And then we take a look at what marketing activity happened before those major points. And then we give it like a percentage of the total revenue at the end of the deal. So we'd be able to say 35% of all pipeline comes from trade shows. And even if that's existing customers that are now putting in new orders or expanding their software licenses, we can still attribute that to that trade show because that trade show was what led them to actually take the action to do something else. So I think it's really important if you're doing things like the World Smartest Intersection Project and doing things like creating something like a techno piece of content that goes behind a gate, is every customer or every prospect that interacts with that piece of content, we document and we log that event. And that way, if one of our customers is, like I said, using us for a really simple use case, they want to understand how their technology, what they have today, can be used to do what Detroit's doing, they download that paper, they call that salesperson and say, hey, I want to do what Detroit's doing, we can properly attribute that action back to that paper.
And then this isn't about tooting your own marketing horn. This is about making informed decisions.
That's about finding the dials.
Yeah.
Right. So what you get in
your dial man, not levers.
Or a lever.
Which levers are we going to pull?
I like dials because they can go to 11. But
I was talking about this the other day, that someone should actually start manufacturing 11.
I think so.
Yeah. I think the red swing line statement.
I think that if you only look at a first touch or a last touch. So if you're saying, let's say people come in on webinars and then someone comes in on a webinar, they read six white papers and then buy something. If you're looking at only first touches, you're going to say people are buying things because of webinars.
Yeah.
Even though they went to one and then did six other actions, right? If you're looking at the last touch, then you're going to say it will only be that, you know, the form or like the form that they fill out that says get a quote is like the number one thing to do. You can't turn the dial on that form, right? It's all the actions before and after and in the middle that have that influence.
And it's not going to be perfect.
No.
But it's going to be a best effort.
It'll be representative.
To learn. Yeah. And larger sample sizes will be more instructive.
So, and that way, you know, like, hey, you know, we seem to be doing some really technical writing. That it seems that when people read that content or people that consume that content are twice as likely to purchase.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's turn the dial up on that content.
Yeah. Right. Or you'd mentioned video.
Or video.
Right?
Video is huge for us. We found out through the attribution that we have one video that is a quick 2-minute overview of one of our products. That's just killing it. Like it's doing really, really well.
So it can in terms of topics and length, style. And
right. So you can start to kind of like figure out, well, if you've got that 2-minute video for one of our products, we should really make that 2-minute video for the rest of our products.
And I guess the challenge is every company would probably go, we should have videos for our products. But they might lack the focus or the urgency to do that.
Right.
Whereas having these metrics says, no, we should drop or stop or postpone some of these other activities that aren't delivering the value and the return that we need. and for a quarter or a month or some period of time, focus on these things that we know are very effective. And then we can come back to those other ones that are longer.
And people are used to doing things like this in marketing, especially in digital marketing, where people are looking like AdWord spend or digital advertising and figuring out like what keywords are working, which ones aren't, and what ones we should ramp up on and which ones we should divest in. So there's some aspects of marketing that are like super data heavy because like in the world of digital marketing, they've always had that data. But it's been really hard traditionally to, even for someone that like runs events, to tie like event activities back to revenue, right? Because unless someone fills out an order form or like writes a quote on the back of a napkin at an event, how do you tie that event back to actual revenue?
Well, and you have to be disciplined about collecting that information. So whether it's UTM codes in your, you know, in your URL tracking and everything, and cookies and all that, but in the, you know, in the wet analog world of people walking into your booth,
so that's it.
It means walking up and scanning their badge and maybe logging what the conversation was. And gosh, that takes a bit of effort.
It does. You're right.
It lets you steer better decisions
in the future. So this is, and it's been a big behavioral shift, but it's been pretty good in the sense that we can convince people, like, everyone wants more shows, right? Everyone wants to be at, if like everyone had their way, we'd be at like every show in the world, right? Because everyone wants us to be out there. But the way that you get MyoVision to more shows and really show the return on investment and value of our investment in shows is by helping us properly document our presence at them.
Yeah.
Right? So if you want to be at more shows,
seems so clear.
And you want to demonstrate the ROI of our shows, help us show that they work.
Yeah.
And then we can, you know, put forward the case that shows that these shows are incredibly important.
So
but
that,
an information black hole becomes just an opinion.
Yeah. And you want to bring data to an opinion fight.
Right? Exactly.
So you mentioned there was a little bit of behavioral shifting that had to happen there. And was this something that was done, you know, after you've arrived, like in the time, the year and a half or so
that you've been here? So I think that one of the very first...
And what broader challenges?
Yeah, so the shift to being data-driven, when I first got here, we were looking at solutions, and I was a big proponent of making an investment into the technologies required to do this kind of attribution.
Yep.
For a long time, we didn't have any sort of serviceable data. Like, it was just kind of like...
It's always amazing, right? It's like, all right, the marketing budget is $1 million. Can we spend $5,000 to make sure we use it right? No.
Yeah. But like, even after we started collecting the data, it was probably 6 months before we had any sort of real intelligence out of it. Yep. Like, there's that waiting period for it to actually collect something representative.
Yep. Well, there's got to be that that understanding that it does take a certain sample size. And then if you're running experiments, you know, this is straight out of lean startup, you don't want to run two at the same time because then you're not sure how to attribute the result.
So I think that the biggest change was, again, changing the real world practices to make sure that things like leads get converted correctly in Salesforce, opportunities get created correctly, that people are assigned correctly to orgs and to contacts get converted. Like, there's a real practical day-to-day kind of retraining, because it's truly like all data garbage in, garbage out, right? If your Salesforce data is bad, or people aren't logging leads back from trade shows, or people are coming back with a stack of business cards and putting them on their desk and then calling through those business cards and not putting anything in Salesforce,
there's a professional discipline required, because
right,
a bunch of things have to happen in order to get the output, and if any one of them doesn't, the whole model can break down.
But we've done a good job as a marketing team of basically changing our entire practice to reflect that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a process that when a show ends, the same thing happens every time.
Yeah.
Right? Or like when
it just becomes habit. Right?
Yeah, we run a webinar, there's the 20 steps to running a webinar, and baked into that is proper lead attribution and UTM parameters and that kind of stuff.
Wait, so you're not reinventing it every single time you...
No, it's an iteration, not a reinvention. I think that goes a really long way in just producing stewardship if you can bake it into the process.
I see it as just as being a marketing pro, right? There's a lot of creative outlets in marketing. There are a lot of sort of fun things you can do, but to have those things be effective takes a certain amount of professional discipline to make sure you're doing some of the maybe less glamorous things behind the scenes, like logging conversations from a trade show.
Right.
Or converting an MQL to, or handing it over to the sales team so they can...
There's a bunch of really unsexy work that goes into marketing. Ultimately, like, I think as marketers, we need to be looking at, always used to be looking at the choke point. So wherever we're the weakest, that's where we need to be focusing.
Yeah. Well, there's never a perfect optimization, right?
No. That's it, yeah. Right? Like, unless you have a real pulse on where that weak point is, it's just going to be someone's opinion of where that weak point is.
Yeah.
And back to your saying that you had there, like, if you bring data to an opinion fight, you'll always win.
So, and the data might not tell you what you wanted or what you expected, but the alternative is you ignore it and stick your head in the sand, and then your business collapses. Or you can listen to maybe the hard truth that comes around, and you know, maybe you learn, for instance, that trade shows just don't matter to your business. All right, you can save $400,000 a year or whatever your trade show budget is by not going, and that's gonna ruffle some feathers. You don't rankle feathers. I don't know what it is that you rankle. That's going to ruffle some feathers, but it's the best decision for the business. It might have been unexpected, but you go in genuinely looking to learn the ABLs of learning, right? Always be learning, and you come out better for it.
Yeah. So if you're looking, I mean, like if you're looking to save on the bottom line, let's say you're looking to reduce budget spend, then that's a great way to do it, is to look at what's ineffective. But I think,
well, maybe you're not probably reducing, most, maybe you're moving it.
Well, yeah, I think that's it, right? Like, I think what probably marketers are most often tasked with is growth, right? And being like, we want more leads, we want more interest, we want more.
A dollar spent on this channel
help us grow.
Gives us $350 back.
Exactly.
A dollar spent on this channel. Maybe it gives us a positive return, but less than.
Right. So figuring out where we should move dollars to make sure that we're getting the maximum return. Mm-hmm. Again, if you don't have any sense, especially from a data point of view, then you will be going with whoever has the loudest opinion.
Yeah.
And that has a chance, I guess, of being correct, but it also, there's no real way of knowing. So I prefer to be data driven, and then, well, you get to actually measure the effectiveness of the changes.
And there are times where you might not have the data, right? You mentioned it's going to take a while before you got enough information. And so you've got to start somewhere, and that's where the instinct and judgment and experience can come in, provided you're willing to then listen to it. So let's just close. We've touched on a bunch of cool problems. Everyone loves a problem. What are some of the most significant or common challenges that you think are facing B2B tech companies? You know, just off the top of your head, just a couple of quick ones, whether we've talked about them already or not.
Yeah, I mean, so just to like think back and recap, I think that it's always been perceived, especially in Kitchener-Waterloo, that engineering and developers have been like the hard people to find. I think it's actually, as now being someone that's out there looking for talent and looking for people to join our marketing org and looking for the skills to fill the skill gaps that we have here at our marketing team, I think there's a real need in town for marketers. I think for product marketers and like really people that are able to bridge that gap, as we talked about, between technologies and products. I think there's also just an inherent demand for people like graphic designers, people like web developers that are like more on the marketing side, UX people that are focused more on websites and you know, being part of the marketing stack.
It's as if there's been a collective realization that talented engineering and aggressive sales and even optimized operations aren't enough.
Yeah, I mean, like people, I think there's a genuine need for more marketing talent in Kitchener-Waterloo, or at least for maybe the marketers that are coming out of the universities or Conestoga, the colleges, to have more of a technology bent to them, or to be more interested or more focused on the technology angle, so they can move more cleanly into a tech job. I think that product marketing and the need to have, let's say it's really hard. You can either find an engineer that understands everything about marketing, and then you're kind of teaching an engineer to market, or you find like an engineer that also just has a passion for marketing, and they can be the one that helps tie technical details to solutions and problems. Or you can find marketers and try to teach them to be engineers.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as a marketer, I don't feel bad.
I'm the former, you're the latter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's two ways to solve that problem, but I feel like it's pretty rare to find people that can fill those two buckets.
And it takes time to develop.
It does. It does. I mean, like, it's not to say that people can't do it, but, actually, you know, in a fast-paced tech world, you need people that can step in quickly. Like, a project like the World's Smartest Intersection, you know, we don't have 2 years to work on it, or a year, right? It's like, this is an idea, we want to do it, we want to go execute.
It's like a June 2nd. Launch or whatever
it was. It happened fast because everything moves pretty fast in tech. So it's hard to get someone on board and you say, okay, in 8 months, you'll know everything about marketing or tech. So I think there's a real gap in town, and this is where Cromulent came in for us, was in...
He's saying this unsolicited,
I'm saying this unsolicited, but is helping bridge that gap and kind of being a little bit of a product marketer or a white paper generator or a technical showcase generator on our behalf. So, you know, the entire marketing team was focused on all the different integrated aspects of marketing. We needed someone to come in and be very quickly a technical expert. And I know from your work at Sandvine, that's your jam, right? That's like what
this
you
is
do,
my jam.
What you do best. So I was super happy to kind of have you as part of that project because, again, under a super tight timeline, and either we didn't have the bodies internally to handle it, so we needed to kind of be able to trust someone to come in, turn it around really quickly, have the technical chops to understand what different protocols are and do, and what edge compute is and what cloud compute is, and not have to teach someone that might be a content writer that writes on a whole bunch of different topics. Mm. At a very high level, to bring them up to technical speed would have just been an extraordinary amount of work on us. So it'd probably been easier for me to write it myself instead of sleeping.
Yeah, yeah. But I had
so much going on that, like, to bring in someone that already has the technical chops, and the marketing chops, and just to lay out the framework of what it is and what it did, and be able to hand that off was extremely valuable. And I think that is as we have tech companies in town that the majority of us in town are B2B, right? Like, there's not a whole lot of consumer technology companies in town that I'm going to assume a lot of people share this common challenge, which is how do we bring our technology into our content stack in a way that actually speaks to the technical user while having fairly limited resources to extremely technical marketers.
Yeah. Great. Well, Matt, thanks very much for your time. And I know I took up more of it than we'd planned, and apologize for that. And thank you for your generosity.
You're very welcome.
And for bringing Cromulent into the World's Smartest Intersection. It was a really neat, fun project to be involved in.
Yeah, thanks for being part.
And congrats on all the success for that.
Yeah. Here's to many more exciting projects in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Matt.
Cheers.
Matt was leaving to go to a meeting, but as it happened, the meeting got postponed, and so we ended up chatting for about another 20 minutes about the attribution model that MyoVision uses for their digital marketing content. I'm sure we could fill an entire podcast with that, though, so we're going to leave that one for a future session. So I'll disclose by once again thanking Matt for taking the time out to chat with me today, and to thank all of you for listening. And with that, I will close off the first ever Cromulent Marketing Community podcast.